Hello, everyone. This is your host, Manoj Tandon. Welcome to another episode of Dark Rhino Security, Security Confidential. Today, we have an awesome guest joining us, Mr. Chandrasekhar Pandey. Chandra joins us from Massachusetts. He is the CEO of Secion. He's been in the cybersecurity space for a very long time. He has 20 plus years of experience with many different organizations, ranging from IBM to Lucent to Juniper Networks, has an amazing background, several patents to his name, has been a disruptive innovator in the industry, and we're just honored to have him here. And Chandra, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We're eager to hear a little bit about your story.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Manojji. It's a great opportunity for me to join you. I have known you for long period of time, and this is the first time actually I have an opportunity to join you on the in this show. I know I watch your show, I watch your episodes. Thanks for giving me opportunity to be part of this session today, sir.
That's a vote of confidence for someone like you to say that. That's thank you so much. We're honored. So you know, we have so many entrepreneurs that come on this show. But one thing that is so unique, you know, when you were able to make this appearance, is that we look at, when you look at the Indian culture, the Indian subcontinent, so much of people from India, for understandable reasons, it's a culture that favors job security. You know, it's about having security, being financially secure, getting a good education. That's the focus. And it's just not India. Even I would say a lot of Asian cultures probably fall into that category. But you grew up in that culture and you said, no, you know what? I'm going to break out of that and I'm going to take a risk. So how did that happen? And what motivated you to do that?
First job I worked was a company called CDOT. Which was founded by a gentleman. He had a big influence in that to founding that organization in India. He worked over here in US,
okay.
And he went back there and he helped the government launch bring a revolution to the telecom sector in India. So I was working over there. And they mostly picked up the young kids, and then young kids were supposed to do the research and create a telecom equipment, whether it was switching or transmission equipment and all that. And that very few senior people were there, mostly young people were part of it. So when you go in there, it was you were doing the things from the scratch. Nothing existed. It was a cutting edge research we were doing, especially when I was working at that time. You know, it's like SDH and all that. Everywhere it's like new thing was happening. SONET, as in the US, people used to call SONET. So I had opportunity to do ASIC, FPGA, and do those kind of work. And so it got it like, hey, you can do anything you want. You know, so that kind of thing came into there. And then when I came to US, I had opportunity to work into, I came from the electronics engineering background.
Right.
So I was working on it's like those ASIC, FPGA and processor designs and then board designs and all that in there, making an electronic system there. And then after the, you know, it's like being here for a few years, you know, probably I had worked for, I'll say 7-8 years. I got opportunity that in 2000 to come and be part of the Lucent, lead a big project over there with a lot of very talented engineers. I'll say it's like it was fun to have that team working with me, and you learn from your team. So,
oh, yeah.
So those drove into that confidence that, hey, look, job, any job you want, you can get to find a job in there. But if you can go and create something and have that create thousands of jobs around it, that was like a big satisfying kind of like opportunity.
If I recall, Juniper Networks stock had a meteoric rise, right? It it did really, really well for quite some time. I hope you folks got a chance to participate in that success of the company.
That's a great question. So see, Juniper, I was not as a very early on guy, but I joined 2005. And I'll say I was definitely lucky, first of all, that I got chance to lead the solution architecture and engineering team. And then also, if you remember that around, that when the challenge financial crisis happened and all that in there, 2008, 2009, a lot of things were going south. Juniper has done a pretty phenomenal job in investing in the R&D, which gives us opportunity for us the stock to kind of like do really well during those time frame in there. And everybody who was at the Juniper, they did really well. There was a very good CEO. I'll tell you, Juniper had Scott Green was the CEO. And I think he was such an authentic person. It's like with the high integrity, some of the things he had said, any engineers can go and meet him. Forget about you don't have to be a senior person in the company, because he was such a simple person to meet. And you learn from the people around, it's you. And he was one of those person that I'm pretty sure anybody who was in the Juniper into those days when he was a CEO will say that, he's just like great person. You can have a discussion with him in the cafeteria, in the hallways, anywhere you want, He was that kind of easily accessible person out there. So it's a Juniper, definitely was a great company.
In mentioning that, I have to ask, is that a culture that you've adopted at Sekion as well?
Yeah, so you see, exactly. One thing I'll say, at the Sekion, a lot of things is like I had the opportunity to learn, because I said all the way from my first job, I was pretty lucky. Most of the organization, we had very open culture, except for some which were like, it was such a big company, it was not that kind of open. But most of the time, I'll say from my first company to the Juniper to even the company, we had the first startup, Internet Photonics. It was a pretty open culture. And open culture, what does it mean? Is everybody knew what is going on inside the company. Everybody was kind of like leader of making the decision and never being held back like, hey, it's like you are not a decision maker and all that in there. So that kind of gives the people a lot of freedom, as well as, it's like accountability and responsibility to grow up into the leader. Just to give you an idea, and it's like, I do all-hand meeting on every Friday, and those meetings, everybody knows exactly what is going on in the organization. Nothing is kind of like, behind the closed doors and all that. So people know it. People know the good things. People know the challenges. What are the things we have to kind of work together to overcome? And everybody kind of like contributes the ideas, and we execute on it, because look, at the end, you pointed out that, look, we are not a very big company in the cybersecurity point of view. If you look into, there are companies which have thousands and multiple.
We're not a big company either. So, but you're bigger than us. So,
yeah. So we have maybe 100 plus people in our team. But if you look into the kind of the innovation we do, a lot of companies, even with the 1,000 people, they cannot do it. And that is only possible by, working in the big organization as well as the small one. What you end up learning is, if you want to make like innovation, what you have to do is you have to empower your people, and does not have like a lot of like, it's like if and then and all that in there. You have to go in and say, let's have a discussion. We can have a lot of open-end things in there, but once we kind of come to the conclusion, let's go and execute it,
When you look at innovation and entrepreneurship, what is more important, the culture one comes from or the culture that one finds themselves in?
Yeah, I will say it's like culture one kind of like you define. Look, we always learn from the people as well, because one thing I always tell my team that, look, you might be here for a longer period of time. Somebody may walk through the door. One of the things is like we have to always keep in mind that, you know, we have a set of values. We kind of like, you know, you mentioned about Juniper. Now I'll share with you. Juniper used to have set of the values, you know, that hey, these are the value we live and kind of like by that. And those were written out there. And then people live with that. And same thing we have into the Sekhyan that, hey, these are the value. Everybody has should have a respect for everyone else. Even if somebody walked through the door the first day, you should respect them, respect their thought and opinion, listen to them and learn from that. You know, you should not assume that, oh, I know everything and they know kind of like very little and all that, because the some of the things they can contribute and they can bring on the table, which we may not have ever thought about it. So always be willing to not only just respect, but learn from each other as well. And then, you know, it's like the good things start happening around the organization anyway, you know, it's like.
It's a very inclusive and positive approach. And it's interesting to hear you to describe it. And especially someone like, as you mentioned, you have a very strong electronics engineering background. So one would never have, you know, there's a lot of biases out there and people typically wouldn't guess that someone with as strong a background as you had on the technical side would become a business leader. But I have to ask in that regard, was there anything in particular that you want to share that in a challenge in transitioning from being a technical engineer to a business leader? What was that transition like for you?
Yeah, you see, you know, one thing, Pinoji, I'll say that I'm not sure whether I really are one side or other side. Clearly, you can mark it. But coming from the background, the opportunity I had to see everything together, whether from the enterprise side, even like, you know, applications, as well as the networking and firewalls and all that, it gave me opportunity that, hey, if we take all the telemetry together and we are able to kind of create a platform where we can put the context and situational awareness. And luckily what was happening in the industry is a lot of innovation which has happened into the silicon side. So whether it is SSD coming into the place to make the data available, to bring the context and situational awareness at pretty fast level, quickly. Memory interfaces and the memory sizes growing up significantly. So you can put terabytes of data, sometimes hundreds of terabytes of the data with the SSD and memory together, close to kind of like a real-time decision-making process. So all of a sudden that analytics capability has come there. Electronics has made it possible to now do that context situational awareness, able to do machine learning and put that domain specific AI. It's like, you know, these days people, a lot of people will talk about AI. This AI today is like, you know, it's like what used to be NLP, now that has evolved into like, you know, regenerative AI in there. That's what you are talking about, the LLMs and all that in there. And that will see, right now you have big hype in there. The hype will come down significantly, but what will happen is some good things is going to come out of that as well. But that is not is something which that LLM is basically is like, you know, you can, somebody can feed the wrong data and you can have like a lot of like, you know, it's like useless information come out. So I'll give you an example that what we did.
You're saying AI can give useless information? People won't believe that, but that, thank you. That's.
Yeah. I mean, look, you can have hallucination coming out of the AI, like especially regenerative AI in there, because the context is really important. And if you see, if you want to find a specific domain related problem, then that regenerative AI is not into that, that you have to feed a lot of domain specific kind of like intelligence. Yes. And you are trying to solve a problem which has to be very, very specific. So just to give you an idea, where the the regenerative AI will play a big role in there, because, you know, it's like one thing is like you can feed a lot of data and give some generic Q&A and all that in there. So that's something is like you can, somebody has fed in there, because at the end it has to read the data and make a derive the result out of that. And that how you make sure that the data you are giving it to read is accurate data. If you just open it to the public, there is a lot of conflicting informations are out there. So how will make that decisions? And then also, if you do not bound it, so that's where you have parameterize it, bound it. So give the answer from out of the data you are kind of like asking it to learn from. So it can have a context, but you can say, no, I still need answer coming out of the data I gave you. That's right. Otherwise, you will give the answer, you will get the answer, which might be not what you were kind of like trying to get out of it as well. So just to give you an idea, you know, it's like we have been doing AI for like, you know, 9 years since we started our company in there, because that one is a domain specific AI to bring the situational awareness and the context. So that one you cannot replace with the LLM and all that in there, that regenerative AI. What you can do where the regenerative AI kind of gives you a lot of meaningful things you can do. If you have a good size infrastructure and all that, you can feed your own set of the knowledge bases. And based on that knowledge base in there, now you are able to get a answers out of it. Sometimes even you generate the questions and the feed the answer yourself in there, yeah. But it's a lot of work also. That is not a free, because that requires you to do also work. Because you see, as a human, what we do is we understand a lot of things by drawing a picture. We draw a picture, and that picture can explain a lot of things very quickly. That's right. Because you can create a workflow and say, okay, hey, this is what it is. And human can understand it quickly and say, I got it. Now, the challenge is with the LLM, you can't do that. So you have to, if you had something drawn in a picture, now somebody has to go in and write like 20-page explanation in very nice way and all that. And if you have an answer coming out of that, even the reader will say, forget it. I don't have a time to read that 5 pages of answers in here. I need something quick, you know? So see, a lot of, it has its own advantage and it has its own challenges, still a long way to go. And definitely it's like it will add a lot of value, because wherever you have a rich set of the data and the data which is authentic data, you cannot just kind of give the all the data out there, because a lot of conflicting data will confuse it, it will hallucinate, it will give you information which will make you kind of shoot on your foot itself. So you want to be always careful to bound the problem and make an answer come out of what you want it to kind of learn from and give you the answer, you know?
So it sounds like we're still a long ways away from having the average person just program their own AI engine. Maybe in another 10 years we'll get there, but as you have described it, and you've done it very succinctly, that we have to bound the problem, we got to have the right data set, we have to parameterize it, and then only are you going to start seeing meaningful results that will come out of the system. Otherwise, you'll get all kinds of ad hoc.
What end up happening is you put something and it gives you answer you wanted to see. You become very happy that, oh, it's kind of phenomenal in there. But then you kind of keep on prompting it for a few more things in there, and you start seeing that, hey, now you are getting answer which is not accurate there. And look, there are companies which are spending billions of dollars, and they know very well that it's a lot of hallucination happens in there. And the biggest challenge you have it is like, look, this thing is like really powerful, but this powerful things require you to have a lot of human work to be done to feed that kind of knowledge. And if you think that, you know, it's like, I will let it just go and get the knowledge from the internet and all that. You saw that a lot of those where like legal cases are going on. Yeah. I think it's like a lot of media's houses are saying that, hey, they are taking our proprietary information and trying to give the answers out of our work and all that in there. And there is a lot of issues like that is going to happen, because if it is a reading from public sources, you see, somebody told that engine that, hey, these sources are reliable sources and you should pick the data from there. There are other sources which are not reliable, so don't read it. So it is a reading for that, but who owns that work? You know, so now it is like you saw there are a lot of legal cases that are happening out there.
But they put it in the public domain as well, right? So they if it was...
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's like, you know, those things are going to be like, you know, kind of questionable. But at the same time, a human is also putting that work that, hey, which one is a reliable source, which one is not. And sometimes even the source might be an opinion, not the fact. That's right. So those ones also you have to care about. But you see, this is like an engine. Whatever you get put into there, just make sure you don't put the conflicting information, and then it will give you quickly answer out of that, instead of you going and searching through the, like, you know, your 500 pages book or 5,000 pages book to go to that particular page. Now this is giving you answer very quickly, and some meaningful correlations are there, but not not something which you can completely say that, ah, that's kind of going to do everything for us. That's, it's going to take a long period of time, you know. And it may not be done as well. I'll be the first one to say that.
A question here is, from what you have described, with all the human effort going into it, and specifically in regards to a SIM, do you ever see a future where we can get rid of the human in the SOC? And just have the SIM be totally automated just on AI?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I will say that one word answer is no. And the reason it is no, I'll say is like, you know, you can minimize, you know, you can make it very efficient and all that in there. So where you are had to put like a 10 people, you might have to put one people there in there, because all the context and all that has been brought. I mean, see, at the end, when we put the AI and ML with the context, we never have the AI make the full decision, because there is a lot of more data. There are certain things where ML and AI then used to have to tell you that this is a bad thing in there. The context was just like, okay, I'm looking into something right now in this context, what has been seen in the past. And the past can be multiple years down to the multiple hours to multiple days, multiple months. That if a human has to do all that work, because you see that you asked that great question and you were talking about it, if a human has to look into the billions of data points to come out with the decision, that will be very tiring and time
consuming. It'll be very unreliable.
Yeah, but you still need like a human to kind of like make a decision. And it may not be all the decision. There are certain decisions you want to kind of like take where you want human to be involved as well.
So, you know, on that, I have to ask you again, getting back, taking a step back, why develop a SIM? Like there's so many out there. When you started this company, and cybersecurity is such a big field, why a SIM? And how do you differentiate? How do you differentiate yourself in that?
Yeah. So you see, this is a really interesting question, because when we started Sekyan, we did not even think about SIM or SOAR. SOAR was not even a name at that time. Yuba was not a name. Okay. So whole thing was is like, hey, we wanted to create a threat management platform which takes everything, put into the context and situational awareness, and then surface the threat before it is too late. So if somebody's compromised credential is happening, that credential is getting used to do some suspicious activity, some malicious activities are happening, you are all detecting that and putting it into a story, in the single story, that where a human does not have to do all that work. So you proactively detect a threat into the early steps and stages, and then take an action to also eliminate, contain the threat. One of the biggest thing, if you remember, SOAR came in later on, but we started talking about eliminating, containing the threat in the SecYAN in 2015. And it was because the background we came from, that you remember mentioned about networking background. So we know that, hey, if I know that, hey, there is some malicious activity, some actors are outside trying to do, or they have already made a home and they are beaconing over there or connecting over there, let's cut it off on the firewall. Let's cut it off from your identity management system. And complete organization come alive, that nothing is going to be hidden from us. That's right.
Yeah.
And a lot of flows might be even duplicate. We will be able to look into dedupe and all that in there. So even if you cannot get a log, still we are watching the whole organization. So the whole company, we started with that, hey, we will have a proactive threat detection, containment elimination, and you meet any compliance requirement you want. And then as we started going through, the people said, huh, you guys do SIEM, you guys do UBA, you guys do NDR, you guys do SOAR, you have a threat intelligence. So all of a sudden, it started looking like, hey, you have collapsed 20 different cybersecurity stack into the single platform. But we did not started with the SIEM. It was the other people who started saying that, oh, you guys do all these things in there. So I can replace my SIEM, I can replace my NDR, I can replace my SOAR, or, any other things out there, So if you look into, that's the way we got into this business,
Wow. So your vision was originally something, you were looking at a threat detection, elimination, awareness engine. I'm oversimplifying it. And the market morphed it into a SIEM. Essentially. And these are the kinds of things that we looked at. And I want to make it very well known to our audience that we actually do business with you, and you are our SIEM provider in our SOC. And it's been very effective. But these are real stories. And it's amazing that the technology has come this far, because it used to be that we would probably have triple the number of people in our SOC in a very traditional setup, if you will. But now the technology has come to where the automations reduce that amount. So Chandra, we're almost at the hour. I wanted to make sure you got a chance to also plug anything you wanted to.
One thing before we started the session, you were asking about, culture and then, so doing the entrepreneurship and all that in there. I said definitely, I was lucky that I had chance to work in some organization around the people. But at the same time, I'll say that, a lot of we grew up in a culture where job safety and was a critical part of it. So taking some of those risks are one of the things you always think that whether people will take it or not. And I'll just give an example of my kids. Both of them, they work in the high-tech industry and all that. But one thing we always discuss that I did not have that luxury, but some of the kids who grew up over here, especially, they have opportunity to not only do a job, but also have opportunity to create job for thousands of people, because they are smart, getting through the college over here and getting a degree is not easy in the U.S. I can tell you, getting through those high school STEM program makes it very difficult for the kids to go through those STEM program. And then getting the engineering degree for here is not easy. So those kids are super smart, and they have a lot of capability, and they have opportunity to create a lot of innovative company, and it happens in the US. So I'll say definitely they have opportunities. And I always say that, if you just do the job, you are doing good for you and your family and a few people around you. But if you do like your own company and make it successful, means like it's always, you know, if you put the efforts together and means there is a good chance of being successful out there. Sometimes you might have some challenges and all that, but most of the time, if you keep on trying, you will succeed anyway.
Yeah.
So my kind of like always advice to the children is like, hey, do something good for, not for just for yourself, but the people around you and community around you, and create thousands of jobs. That is the biggest impact you can make in society. If you can do it, that is something is like very honorable, and, you know. And it's not always about making the money, but it's like, you know, always doing something for the people around you and the society is a big, big kind of satisfying things. Because, you know, money and all that, you know, it's like, I don't know what, you can have a lot of money, what you'll do with it. But sometimes if you had the money and you can create opportunity for thousands of people around you, that is some big satisfying things in anybody's life, you know.
Yeah. We had a gentleman, Matt Brown, on our show. I think he was the last guest before you or one before that. I drew a blank with it. But he's interviewed some of the most successful entrepreneurs in the world. And one of the things he pointed out was, and you're making that point, that people who are successful often, it's not about the money. It's about being involved with a cause bigger than they are and giving an output that is not centered on them, but is for the betterment of humanity in its larger context. And I guess that's why you've been so successful.
Yeah, I will not say successful and all that. It's long term, we'll tell it. But one thing I'll say, Manoji, you said something very powerful there that, you know, look, making impact for the society. And one thing I'll say that when we started Sakyan, the goal was that, you know, and it's always going to remain. I always talk about making the comprehensive cybersecurity affordable for the organization of any size. And that goal we have stuck with. I'll tell you that today morning I was having a discussion with somebody. Somebody was interviewing with us from one very big company. And then I asked them, like, how you came to know about Sakyan? And, you know, it's like one thing was very interesting. He said, you know, we are told in our company that, hey, if you hear Sakyan is on the table and customer understand what Sakyan does, just walk away from those one in there, because most of the time Sakyan is like, you know, what they bring in the table, we cannot match and all that. And they are the company which is affordable for even the smallest of the company to the largest of company can get a better ROI on it. And I was pretty surprised whether I should take it a negative or positive. But one of the my team member, he was on the call as well. And he said, Chandra, that is extremely positive things, he said, you know, that his company's leadership is telling that if you hear Sakyan is on the table, just run away from it, you know, because you'll never win it.
You're going to be successful, because with statements like that, if that continues, you guys are going to get bought out and you'll be the next $2 billion deal in the newspaper. So
it's a long way to go.
These things happen very quickly. Chandra, you've been an awesome guest. Thank you. And as things develop, please stay in touch and you're always welcome back. Appreciate your appearance here. And thanks for the great knowledge and the good conversation.
Yeah. Thank you, Manoji. Thanks for the opportunity, sir.
Thank you.